And this is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the University of Arkansas School of Law hosted the 2020 version of the Food Law Student Leadership Summit. The first summit was in 2015 at Harvard. Subsequent editions have been hosted in Iowa, at UCLA, and at Georgetown University. During last week's summit, we invited Emily Broadlieb, the director of Harvard Law School's Food Law and Policy Clinic, to come to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss how the summit began and what takes place at the summit. She says since the first year, law students' interest in food law has been high.
It's funny, when I first started my program, so I had gone to Harvard Law School, I graduated, and I got into food from work that I was doing in the Mississippi Delta for a couple years. And when I came back and was starting out my career back at Harvard Law School, I would go out to lunch with former professors of mine and say, I'm working on food law. And they said, oh, that must be so small. What a small field. It's so narrow. It's, you know, helping get more microgreens at farmers markets. And I didn't know how to explain at that point, you know, this is really quite a big field. And I think one of the things that I've really seen change in the last 10 years since I've been doing this has been that there's a real understanding of the fact that it's not only a really important field, that there's some core kind of laws and doctrines that relate to it, but that also it spans. I mean, food is a nexus to all these other topics. And I think trying to think about, especially from my perspective, making better policy, you have to really think about how food interacts with all those areas. Otherwise, you're making bad policy that it's, you know, it's good for food safety, but bad for the environment, or, you know, good for the environment, but bad for public health.
You said part of this summit this year is climate and food.
Yeah.
What are some of the avenues that can take?
Yeah. So let's see. So I think one thing to know, one of the reasons we were excited to focus on this topic is that food production has a huge impact on climate and, you know, on the environment generally, but, you know, like a third of the greenhouse gas emissions globally come from food production. Last year, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said in August they put out a report just all about climate and land use, and they found that 8 to 10% of greenhouse gas emissions came just from food waste. So
from food waste?
Waste, yeah. So I think there's a lot of ways that food production and systems contribute to climate, but also is very heavily impacted. So we've seen, you know, even in the last few years and kind of worsening impacts on food production from, you know, flood events, drought events, like, you know, superstorms, things like that. So I think we see food, you know, agriculture and food production being in this place where there's both an opportunity to mitigate, but then also how are we preparing to, you know, adapt to the changing landscape. So what that looks like in terms of us at the summit, there's a couple key things that we're doing. One is that our keynote speaker is Representative Shelley Pingree from Maine, who has been a champion the whole time in Congress. I mean, she's, you know, herself a farmer and food producer in Maine, but has been a champion of a lot of different food policy things. So we've worked with her on a lot of food waste related legislation, on you know, local farms and foods support. And she just this week introduced the Agricultural Resilience Act, which is kind of a broad brush piece of legislation that addresses all of these ways that we could direct more resources into research, support for farmers, trying out new innovations. Like, one piece of it is like a testing out some sort of tax incentive for farmers to sequester carbon to see what works so that we can kind of build that up. So she'll be the keynote. We are having an entirely vegan menu for the summit, which I think is also, you know, there's, you know, differing amounts of climate impact from consuming different animal products, but especially consuming beef right?
Yeah.
Right. So we're having a completely vegan menu. And then a couple of the panels will have a climate focus. And then also the students every year do one engaged simulation. So we've every year done them different ways. And this year they're going to do a simulation of a climate negotiation. So they're assigned different roles. They have some time tomorrow and then on Sunday to prepare. And then they present the policy solutions that they come up with these like pretty adverse roles of, you know, food producers and food technology organizations and government and small farmers trying to negotiate a couple solutions.
You've mentioned partners where you go. Who are some of the partners that are working with you here?
So this has been really exciting because we've been trying to get it together to bring it to University of Arkansas for a few years. And one of the reasons that it worked really well is that in addition, I've had a longstanding, you know, personal and professional partnerships with Professor Susan Schneider, who runs the LLM program in ag and food law here. But now Dean Margaret McCabe came down, and the three of us all together were founding members of the Academy of Food Law and Policy, which is a academic association. But so now that Dean McCabe is here as well, we thought, well, this is perfect time to kind of bring this amazing summit here. But it's been in the works for some time. And I have to also say they both are people that from the start of my career were really helped me get my career launched in this field, too. So it's just a real pleasure to be here.
Growing up, you know, we may have heard clean your plate. But what could food waste mm-hmm. legislation look like?
So this is actually something I spend a lot of time looking at. You know, what are the systemic, what's the ways that government can either make it easier to not throw food away or to align incentives? So there's a couple policies that I think we've worked on and that Representative Pingree has looked at. One big one is around the date labeling on food products. So, you know, the reason I bring this one up a lot, of course, it's not on every single product. It's, you know, just the packaged goods. But I think there's really good evidence that it would be the single most cost-effective solution because it just we already see date labels on products. The problem is that people don't know what they mean. So
Best Buy
right.
is not
enjoy buy,
right.
you know, sell buy. So we know that about nearly 90% of consumers will say that they throw food away because they think it's not safe. And what we've tried to push for, and there's legislation pending that Representative Pingree had introduced, and a companion bill is also in the Senate, that would require all food, if a food producer wants to put a label on, they need to either pick best if used by for foods where it's just about quality to really say to you, if this still tastes good, you're not going to get sick. If you right. eat it, if it doesn't taste good, throw it away.
The smell test,
yeah,
too,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, but if it tastes good, looks good, smells good, then it's fine. And then on the foods where it's labeled because the producer really thinks there might be a risk after the date, that the term would be used by. And we can talk about where those terms came from. Mm-hmm. There is some science behind them, but
there's also some marketing, right?
There's some marketing too, but I think the main idea is really that whatever the terms are, we need to really just break food up and you know educate consumers to know that there are some foods, a small handful, where you should be cautious, but the rest, you know, it's really everyone's taste buds are different, and what you know we've actually experimented with milk, and I think everyone had different experiences as far as whether the milk that was a couple days past the date tasted fine to them or tasted a little off, and there's really no risk involved.
You sounded as if when you were doing this first summit, you were kind of, because of so many people who applied for internships, a little bit surprised. I'm not surprised that there is a growing interest, especially among young lawyers-to-be in food law, because it seems to, as you said, touch almost everything we do.
Yeah. I think what I was surprised about was that people would want to, I mean, these are law students, granted, we're paying for their trip to come for the most part. They have some skin in the game for their flight, but once they, you know, we support a big travel stipend. Once they're here, their hotels and their food are covered. But they're coming on a weekend, they're giving up their time, you know, so it really has to be students that are passionate. And I think I agree that it touches on so many things, and I think students learning about this field can also apply it in a lot of the related fields or just to thinking about anything that's you know, policies that impact a complex system. But I think what I was surprised about was that all these students like really wanted to give up their weekend and fly across the country to have essentially a boot camp of like law classes and seminars and panels the whole weekend and then have to perform for the simulation at the end.
Do you see part of your responsibility, not just legal, but also helping educate the rest of us who aren't in food law?
Yeah, I think 100%. And I think, you know, my job is interesting as a clinical professor. I am, you know, professors in the word. I teach in the classroom. I mentor students. You know, I do scholarly writing. But clinic means that we're doing really engaged. So I see myself also probably much more as an advocate or an activist than as a professor. Because if we're thinking about trying to push forward, you know, beneficial business habits or innovations or policies, one of the first steps of that is socializing the concepts and really educating you know, policymakers, the media, the public, so that you can make progress. And I think many people who are involved in food, it's because we think it's important and we think that there's something going wrong right now. But if we want to help get people to some future that's a little bit better, you need to kind of bring people along on the vision.
Are you a lover of food? Would you consider yourself?
I am a lover of food, but that's not why I got into this. But I think it, you know, it's an added benefit that because I think so much of it is also traveling around and working with like different communities and groups we work with that part of connecting is also connecting over the food that people eat together. So that's been, you know, a nice piece. Like when I was first starting doing this work in Mississippi and helping, I was going around trying to get more farmers to sell at local farmers markets in the Delta. And I would come home at the end of these visits out to all these farms with like a bag of peaches, a box of tomatoes, some, you know, ground boar meat from one of the producers had, you know, shot on his property. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was coming home with this like bounty of stuff too. So that was, you know, a really nice added benefit.
If there's growing interest among those in the legal profession, those about to go into it professionally in food law, mm-hmm. is it reciprocated from the legislative end? Do you see legislators, senators, representatives, state legislatures mm-hmm. that are interested in food law?
I will say, you know, we definitely at the state level, I'll start there. I mean, really at both levels, but for example, we track a lot of state legislation on food waste issues. So we talked before about date labeling. We've been tracking state tax incentives for farmers who donate any surplus crops, state liability protections for food donors. So we have like great federal protection, but states can offer additional protection beyond that. And what we've seen in the last legislative session, like the 17-18, you know, two-year legislative session, there were over 100 bills introduced and more than 30 passed. And this legislative session, we're tracking again, and we're at a little over 84 different bills that have been introduced. A lot of sessions are, you know, now's the time when they're kind of we're going to see them getting enacted. But we've been seeing a real rise in the number of states that are looking at this stuff. I think you know, a lot of states are creating state food system plans. So states from Maine to Massachusetts to Illinois have done things like that. And I think it's really acknowledging that if they're not thinking about where their food's coming from and where it's going to come from 10 years or 20 years from now, then they're not, you know, planning really for the health of their people and of their economy. At the federal level, I mentioned before Representative Pingree, she's been amazing. There are, I'd say, a handful of legislators that are really thinking about this and trying to you know, think about what the legislation should look like. But I do think that there's more knowledge generally in Congress than let's say a decade ago. So even the farm bill, which, you know, before the last two farm bills, it was really a small group of legislators on the ag committees in the House and Senate that knew what was going on. They were really engaged. Like everyone else, it came up for a vote and everyone just voted and just, you know, it was really seen as something that was like just for farms. And I think exactly. And now it's seen as a food bill to the extent that it's become more difficult to pass in some ways because people have more stake and they see how it impacts different things that are their priorities. But I think that it also shows that there's more passion around how are we going to solve some of these, you know, societal issues and is this doing it in a way that comports with like what my constituents want or is being visionary for the future?
Because for better or worse, food can be political.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. There's some things that it can be very political. It breaks down on different lines often than, you know, it's not always just a total partisan line breakdown, which is another reason I like working in this space, too, that I think, you know, people care really deeply about certain things. And but, you know, I think the pieces that have been pretty politicized, especially in the last few farm bills, have been around the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or SNAP food stamps and just how much funding is going to that. And so that has gotten really politicized for sure.
All right. You spent time in the Mississippi Delta. Did you learn to love okra?
I love okra.
There you go.
Right, you know why I love it? I love it for two reasons.
Okay.
All right. One is I've always loved it, actually. It was like a food that my mom made growing up that was a family recipe. So my mom's family was from Turkey. and there's like an okra dish that they made. The other reason I love it is that when I was in Mississippi, I was one of the things I worked on was really building the school garden at the local high school. And, you know, farming's hard. Growing food is hard. And the first set of everything we planted was a disaster, except for the okra, which grows in Mississippi no matter what you do. You do nothing and it just comes up. And it was like, you know, taller than me with, you know, these big fat okra on it. And I was like, I love you for showing me this, showing the students that this is possible.
Emily Brodlieb is the director of Harvard Law School's Food Law and Policy Clinic and was on the University of Arkansas campus last week when the School of Law served as the host for the 2020 Food Law Student Leadership Summit. This year's summit had more than 60 students from 41 different law schools from across the country. And this year's focus was on the nexus of the food system and climate.